Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for those who are finally pregnant and parenting after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying with multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which sadly included pregnancy loss, I became finally pregnant in 2018, and I'm now finally parenting my gorgeous daughter, Ren. This season of the Finally Pregnant podcast is sponsored by Tomorrow Life Sciences. Ever wondered how and where your frozen eggs and embryos are stored? They are kept in tanks called dewars. Inside each tank, hundreds of eggs and embryos are submerged in liquid nitrogen. They're identified with tiny handwritten or printed labels, and the clinic manages and monitors them manually. This part of the IVF lab hasn't been updated in decades and also hasn't benefited from technology or innovation. That's where life sciences company Tomorrow comes in. Tomorrow has created the world's first and only automated platform for the management, identification, and storage of frozen human eggs and embryos. What does this mean? Tomorrow's technology replaces handwritten labels with sophisticated digital tracking, which creates an unbreakable digital link between the specimens and the patient. It also automates a huge part of the process, vastly reducing the risk of mistakes and human error. Finally, it monitors the safety of those frozen eggs and embryos 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Tomorrow's state-of-the-art technology gives patients and clinics peace of mind that those precious, irreplaceable frozen eggs and embryos are safe and protected. Tomorrow is being rapidly adopted by a host of clinics across the United States, creating a new and improved standard of care, and will be available in clinics in the UK this year. To find out more, visit tmrw.org. Links in the show notes. Hello there. How are you doing? I am sat here on the Friday of the Jubilee weekend. We are attending some of the celebrations, a disco tonight, a barbecue tomorrow. You know, Ren is basically over the chicken pox. So woo, I can get out, which is wonderful. My dad had his first bowl of porridge just this morning, which is like, whoa, mega news as far as I'm concerned. And it does finally feel like I can take a bit of a breath and think about the future and think about the summer. Although I caveat that with knowing that the last few weeks, and let's face it, the last decade basically, has taught me not to expect anything to go smoothly necessarily. So, you know, one day at a time, one day at a time. Enough about that though, because what I really want to do is talk to you about this week's episode of the podcast. I'm talking to a beautiful Black woman, Mardoche, who shares openly her experiences on her Instagram page, Mermaid Maman, and there's links in the show notes. She says there that she is normalizing Black women and infertility, and now that she is finally pregnant, which is amazing, I'm really honored that she has brought that conversation to the Finally Pregnant podcast. Recognizing that this is Pride Month as well, Mardoche is a gay woman married to her wife Yvette, just if you haven't come across her before. I also want to read a snippet from one of her recent posts. She says, "I hope our story is inspiring for the little Black queer girls who think they could never start a family. You could. This Pride, I'm celebrating our last month together as a family of two and to Black love." I will link to that full post in the show notes too. And I just urge you to head over and give Mardoche a follow. In fact, if you're listening to this podcast, why not screenshot the episode whilst you're listening, share it on your Instagram and tag us both. Let's really get this message as far and wide as we can. If any of the issues raised in our chat affect you, please know that you are not alone. Please know there are millions of people who want to change things, and that if I can do anything as one person to progress that change, I am here. In the show notes, I have linked to the Five Times More report that I mentioned in the interview. Please, whoever you are, put some time aside and read through it. It's just, you know, unless we have these conversations, and I know that we've heard this a lot over the last couple of years, but, you know, it's just so important. And please read, please listen, please share. please get involved and please go and give Five Times More a follow too. Links to everything, as I say, in the show notes. Huge thanks again to Mardoche for sharing her story with me. And huge thanks to you for listening to this episode and all of the episodes of the podcast. Take care. Bye-bye. Before we head into today's chat, I want to remind you just how important it can be to talk and share our stories with people who get it. That's just one of the reasons I created this very podcast. And you already know how important that is because you're here to listen to people whose experiences you relate to. But I want to give everyone the opportunity to talk. And that is just one of the reasons I launched The Hangout, a community specifically for those who are finally pregnant and parenting after infertility and loss. When you join, you'll receive a free meditation, access to a 24/7 community, invitations to exclusive live podcast recordings with experts across all areas of pregnancy and parenting, a full and growing resource library, support groups, discounts, and more. Find out more at catstrawbridge.com. I look forward to seeing you there soon. Hi there, Mardoche. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. And I am delighted to have this conversation in because unfortunately, due to some personal reasons for me, we have had to reschedule a couple of times. So huge apologies. But it's really, really, I'm just delighted that we have managed to talk before little baby Roo arrives, because you are quite far along now, aren't you? You're 36 weeks.
I'm ready for him to come out.
Oh, bless you. Bless you. Now, if I can hand over to you, I guess, and you can just tell us a bit about who you are and how you've come to be 36 weeks pregnant. That would be amazing.
Okay, totally. So my name is Mardoche and I've been married to my wife, Yvette, for about 3 years now, but we've been together almost like nine. It's insane. I grew up with her, basically. We immediately started trying once we got married. She's in the Army. So while she was away, I kind of started the process before her. So we tried at home for about a year, nothing. And I was kind of concerned, like, you know, like I'm 25. At the time I started, I was like 24 going into 25. I'm like, I'm young. Like, I shouldn't be having these like issues. So we finally decided to see an OBGYN. The first one, it was like typical, like how everyone kind of talks about, oh, you're young, drink wine, relax, you'll be fine. So we tried again a few more months and still nothing. And I was like, I honestly think something's wrong. So I finally decided to seek help. And that's kind of how like my fertility journey started, was that my OB noticed that I had PCOS and was like, this is above my scope of practice. I'm going to send you to an RE who can better assist you. So that's how kind of like my fertility journey started. And Yvette and I were always doing it at the same time. So we both got tested at the same time. She was diagnosed with unexplained infertility. So we both decided to just go ahead and seek help. But we were at two different clinics, which was so weird and really annoying because we would always miss each other's appointments because it was like usually scheduled around the same time. So that was really hard. But then she got deployed. So her journey stopped, but mine continued. I did four IUIs without her, who resulted in losses, and the other two just didn't work. So I took a break. I was really devastated. I needed to get surgery. So I got surgery. I reconvened a plan and I did IVF. So my first round of IVF, we transferred two embryos, and 2 weeks later, you know, I took a pregnancy test and we were pregnant. So it was a very long journey. It was almost 3 years, but it's definitely worth it because at the end, I call Rue my finally baby because it was just a very long and stressful journey. It was like loss after loss. And, you know, it was just, it felt great. And then when Yvette got back, we were so excited on this momentum. Like, okay, like, you know, like, let's try to get you pregnant. And we were excited. And unfortunately, her first IUI ended in a loss, which was hard because at that point, I was about 4 or 5 months pregnant, dealing with loss and grief, but then also trying to make sure that I was still happy and present for Rue's arrival. So it's been hard, but, you know, we find joys and when we can, and when we don't feel joyful, we don't, and we accept that.
Absolutely. Gosh, yeah, that is a kind of a complex, like everyone that joins me, I guess, has a complex journey too, but in different ways. Now, can I ask a really, perhaps a very basic question, but to the uneducated? So you are a same-sex couple. When you say you were trying at home, so before you went to the fertility clinic, can you talk me through that? Like, is that all right?
Yeah. So we started off using a known donor. So we had a friend. He was also a part of the LGBTQ community. So he completely understood like how we're limited resources. He was a man of color. So he understood like just how hard it would be for two Black women to try to conceive. So he was very willing to donate. We would track our ovulation. But for me, which was weird, like now that I think back at it, because I have PCOS, was I didn't ovulate all the time. So I was like, man, I would miss windows, but Yvette consecutively would, every month we would inseminate her. So we got like a MOSI kit. It's like an inseminate at home insemination kit. And I would inseminate her like as if it was an IUI, but I was doing it at home. So we were doing that for almost 10 months, just consecutively, like every month. And whenever I would ovulate, I would try. And it just wasn't working out. So I was like, maybe I'm not doing it right. You know, like I've watched a million videos. We talked to the OB about it. And, you know, I thought we had it down, but it wasn't working. So like, that's what we mean by trying at home, was that we would just do it ourselves at home. It's cost savvy. And we had a lot of friends who tried at home and it worked for them. So we're like, okay, we're 24, we're 25. Like it should totally work. Like we're young, like what could possibly go wrong? And then, you know, it was kind of like a foreshadowing of how our journey would be.
Sure, sure. Thank you so much for explaining that. And then when you went to the clinic, and I don't know if it's the same in America as it is here, but often when you go as a couple, as a heterosexual couple, the man gets ignored. Now, the fact that you were both going through this, like as women, like it's just amazing to hear, you know, you both having your tests done. Like that's how it should be with any couple, isn't it? Completely. Yeah. But when you were going through your IVF, well, and the IUI for a vet as well, you have used a donor sperm. And so is that a known donor or is that non-known?
It's an unknown donor. Unknown. So like the more research I started doing about like LGBTQ rights and like, because we were always trying at the same time. So I was like, to protect ourselves, like we're going to have to adopt these babies. So like the more I started talking to like legal and figuring out like what would be best for our family, I realized that using an donor that I didn't know through a cryobank would cut my legal costs in half, because then he wouldn't have to, like, I would have to pay him or pay the court to have him relinquish his rights, and then I would have to continue my adoption procedure. So we just decided that since we had the money and we were in the position to do it, to go through a cryobank. So that's what we ended up doing. So Rue was conceived via unknown donor.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing. And so it worked and baby Rue was conceived, which is just amazing. Like I almost want to talk about, because I remember when you announced the news that Yvette was pregnant and then unfortunately she had lost the pregnancy. I kind of want to talk about that, but also I guess you are pregnant and I kind of want to focus on that. But I can imagine having gone through losses yourself, you know, that repeated grief and that accumulation of grief that we all feel when we're trying and it's not working. And then when there's losses and then, you know, Yvette's loss probably impacted you in quite a similar way, I guess, to your own.
I felt guilty because like I've been on the other side where it's kind of like I had posted on my page, like, I'm happy for you and sad for me. So I guess I carried a lot of guilt during that month. Like January was a very dark time for us. And it was really hard because our anniversary was that month. But it was like, I carried a lot of guilt because she was kind of like, okay, it happened. Let's just like try to move on. Let's focus on Rue. And she completely divulged into like being the best mom that she can. But like, you can see it in her eyes that she was hurt. And that she was grieving, and that, you know, like you kind of start to question yourself, like, why doesn't it work for me? And like, unfortunately, in her journey, it always starts and then it stops and it starts and then it stops because of like uncontrollable events. Like she's in the army and then she doesn't have the leisure like I do to take a day off and go to the fertility clinic. It's very strategic and it puts a lot of limits for her. So like, we almost didn't even know when the next time she could try, because just the way what her job is and waiting for her body to get back to where it needs to be to try. And then here I am like growing a baby. And it's like, yes, that's her son and she's excited. But at the same time, you go through fertility treatments with the intent to be pregnant. So I couldn't, it's like almost you couldn't ignore that even if we tried. And I just carried a lot of guilt because like I've been on the other side where you're just as supportive and you're very happy for the loved one or the friend, but at the same time, you're like dying on the inside. Yeah. So it was very hard.
And how is Yvette doing? Is she okay?
She's okay. She has her days. I think like 2 days ago was a rough day for her. This IVF process, like getting her started, has been really hard because we moved. And then now she needs surgery. So it's like, it's up in the air. Like the uncertainty of infertility is worse than getting a negative test because you don't know when you can start again. And then you start looking at the time and birthdays go by and months go by and people who are just trying are now pregnant. So I think she started getting a little bit of anxiety because she kind of said like, what if I don't carry? Like, what if I can't carry? And it's like, I don't know when you will, but it doesn't mean that you can't. We just have to figure out a way of how. So it's been hard, but I think that she's an amazing person because I don't think I could have done or have been just like how strong she is if it was the roles were reversed. Because she shows up for Rue and I like every day, never miss an appointment. She's involved, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I'm literally like, she can't run away from a pregnant woman. Like, you know how we avoid like people and stuff? Like, she can't do that. I'm there all the time, like, you know? And she does so well, like even when she's sad, to like make sure that she's present, like, you know, with her son and with her wife. And I don't think that I would have been mentally as strong as she is. And I commend her on it all the time.
She sounds amazing. She sounds very, very special. And I have no doubt you are.
Well, I know.
Oh, I have no doubt that you are to her as well. So, yeah, definitely. And hopefully her time will come very soon. But I hear you, the waiting and, yeah, just, yeah, all of that, as our listeners will too. It's really hard. So coming back to you and your pregnancy, so you've got that to kind of deal with and support Yvette through that and and support your own feelings around that as well. Talk to me about like the first trimester, the second trimester. How were you feeling? Like I came across you on Instagram, and when I think of you, I think of, you know, like your reels, because you knock out these amazing reels. I love them. And you are an advocate, like, you know, hugely for Black women and infertility, going through infertility and pregnancy, you know. So not only are you doing these fun reels, but you have a really strong, powerful message as well that you're relaying via them. Talk to me about your pregnancy journey, I guess. How has that been?
It's been, I would say, like I'm feeling better now. So unfortunately, I have HG, so I throw up all the time. So when I first got pregnant, it was maybe like 5 weeks, and I started feeling really sick. And I told my doctor, and he's like, it's kind of early for that, but like, let me give you like the pretty basic meds that we give for nausea. And I was like, okay. But then like, as the weeks went by, my first trimester, it was just getting worse. And then I started losing like a lot of weight. So then they were like, oh, this is not just like morning sickness. You have something called HG. So like my first and second trimester.
Just going to interrupt you just for a second there. So for anyone who hasn't come across it before, it's hyperemesis gravidarum. I have done one episode with a UK organization called Pregnancy Sickness Support about this specifically. And I've also spoken to someone this episode, actually, Amy Wigg, who has suffered from it really badly. But just in case anyone, wasn't aware of HG, if you are dealing with severe pregnancy sickness or hyperemesis, then please, please do seek support. And it's great that you have done that. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, definitely. Please seek support. It's not easy. It's mentally taxing. My first and second trimester, I think I cried every day because I felt so bad because I hated being pregnant. And it's like, it's something that like I wanted for so long and I got it and I just wasn't having a good time. Like I spent so many nights in the hospital and I missed so many days of work. It was debilitating. I couldn't do anything but like crawl in a ball and just cry. And I hated being pregnant. And I just felt like I started to diminish from my platform because I felt like, oh, I'm a fraud. I'm going to offend other women who are still trying. Like, I have what they want and I'm complaining. So I kind of just disappeared like the first like 20 weeks of my pregnancy, just because I just was miserable. Like, I love Rue, but I would never be pregnant with Rue again. Because like, here I am 36 weeks pregnant and I'm still struggling, like keeping water down. It's debilitating. And I think the first 20 weeks, I just didn't want to, like, I cared so much about the people that I like, the friendships I made and the people who followed me, that I just didn't want to seem ungrateful. So like the first 20 weeks of my pregnancy, I was really sad. I was borderline depressed. Like, I was talking to a therapist. And then one day, I guess I just was like, you know what? Like, the part, like the biggest thing I pride myself in on my platform is that I'm honest all the time. And I kind of just decided to just be vocal about it and say, like, this is what my pregnancy looks like. It's not always peaches and rainbows. It's not always what it seems to be. This is like, this is my life. And that's when I kind of started to spread awareness about it, especially like my target audience is Black women. And I'm like, a lot of them might be going through this, but because of the way we're treated in medical care, like they probably don't know like the right questions to ask or the right medication to get or like what they can do at home, like what your doctor can prescribe you. So I'm like, this can be another way for me to educate people. And I used it positively. And I feel like it helped my mental so much because so many women started reaching out to me. Like, I went through the same thing, or I'm going through it now. Thank you. And it just made me feel better. And like all that guilt I was carrying for 20 weeks kind of just like lifted off my shoulder. And it's made me feel a lot better.
Yeah. It's like so many things, isn't it? Like, when we share and we hear other people say, yeah, I've been through that too. I'm going through that. And we've hidden it, haven't we? And like you say, especially in our situations when we're finally pregnant and we have huge guilt about not enjoying being pregnant, whether that be because of something like HG and sickness or whether it be because of like general anxiety, it's like, I should be so happy to be here. And this is actually really, really hard and really awful. And, you know, like it can be really, as exactly like you say, really debilitating. But your ability to be open about that has no doubt, as you said, like helped other people, because we need to hear these messages, don't we? Like, I didn't know an awful lot about HG until one of my really, really good friends experienced it. And then I realized that she literally couldn't brush her teeth in the morning. You know, that like some people are hospitalized, but you know, it's just until people talk about it and are open about it and you hear about it, because probably because it's happened to someone you know, but Instagram then opens up this amazing, you know, and this amazing community that we have. Yeah. So I commend you for speaking out, and I'm glad that it helped you as well as enabling other people to kind of feel educated and empowered about it. And you mentioned there about kind of, you know, your target audience being predominantly Black women and that they wouldn't necessarily have the understanding of what to ask their medical professionals, that kind of thing. Is that something that has impacted you in your pregnancy throughout, or how has it, I guess, impacted you?
It's impacted me. I would say like the moment I found out I was infertile until being pregnant. And now one of the things that contributes to like reproductive health in Black women is we start off as little girls and our parents just tell us the moment you get your period, stay away from boys. And that's it. We don't talk about like infertility. We don't talk about like, it's important that when you're 16, you should start seeing an OB. Like, we're just taught that if you see an OB or if you wear tampons, you're being a very bad girl. And, you know, like, we don't talk about it. And I kind of never even thought about like, maybe I should have gotten checked, because I've shown signs of PCOS since I was, you know, 14, 15. But because I was taught to be ashamed of my body, I just never thought about it, because it's like the thought and the notion is that I'm Black, I should be fertile. So I think that it starts there, like the lack of education that within our community that we don't have. And then there's the factor that there are white medical professionals who are actually taught in school that Black people have a higher pain tolerance, that we're hyperfertile. So when you enter a space that's predominantly white or overwhelmingly white, it will sometimes frighten you to even ask a question, because the way, like their facial expressions, what they'll say to you, will they believe me? And I faced it so many times, which is why I decided to start my page and kind of document my journey. And I'm honest about the questions that I ask in my experience because I didn't have that. So when, like I said, I was turned down by two OBGYNs before my third doctor, who was a Black woman, said, yeah, there is something wrong. And I think from there, she kind of was the catalyst for me to start doing research about Black women and our reproductive health within white medical spaces, because I had no idea it was ever that bad. Like my mom's a nurse. So like I always went into the places that she worked. So I never was treated like wrong because everyone knew my mom. But then now I'm a 25-year-old married woman going to the doctor by myself in a new state with new people. And I had no idea that that's how the world could be. And I am very thankful for my Black doctor because she kind of like sat me down and was like, this is the world that you live in. And these are the questions that you need to ask. So like that kind of started me, like, if I don't know, I know there's a million other women out there who don't know either. And I'm going to be your advocate because eventually we need change. So that's kind of how like my page started, was just because I was being discriminated against simply because I was Black. No one believed I was infertile. And then once I got my diagnosis, it was a constant back and forth. And like one of my most vivid ones that I talk about all the time that really scarred me was, it was my third IUI and he had me on the same dose, same protocol. And I'm like, we've done two already and nothing's working. Can we please try something else? And it was during, we had a huge Texas freeze and he kind of was like, no, this is protocol. This is what we're going to do. And I'm like, I would like to try something else. And immediately he told me I was being aggressive. And it's like one of the things you don't tell a Black woman, because the way the world has portrayed all Black women is that if I speak my mind, I'm aggressive. And if I don't say anything, then I'm uncomfortable. So I kind of like let it go. And I did the same protocol. And again, nothing happened. And that cycle ended up being canceled. So I felt so defeated, like I should have said something, but it wasn't worth possibly losing a doctor because I really wanted to be pregnant. And I just decided like Black women shouldn't be silent and we shouldn't be mistreated because of something we can't control. Like I can't control that I came out a Black woman, but what I can control is how someone would perceive me or talk to me. So that's kind of like how my page started.
What you've been through is horrible and it's something that no one should go through at all. I've got a couple of quotes, numbers here from people, and it says that Black people are twice as likely to face infertility issues and Black women have a higher risk of miscarriage with both spontaneous and IVF pregnancies. And there's a lot of work in the UK being done at the moment. I will have referred to it in the preamble and there will be links to everything in the show notes. Five Times More have just literally last week released some research that they did last year. And it's just the disparities in the UK. And, you know, from what I'm hearing you say and from other people, you know, it's something that happens all over the world, unfortunately, that we need to talk about and raise. And I, like, hands up, I'm sitting here nervous about that. I'm going to say something wrong, but it doesn't matter if I do. I'm hoping, you know, the point is I want to learn about it. I want to talk about it. I want this platform to share all of these stories because that's the only way that we're going to create that change. So talk to me about how that has impacted you through your pregnancy. Like, I understand from the infertility point of view, that's something that you've found that has impacted you since you've got your positive pregnancy test?
Definitely. I feel like, especially having HG, when I hit 11 weeks and I was down 15 pounds, I'm like, this is not normal. And I will never forget, it was like a doctor that I've never seen. He was filling in for my regular OB. And he said, eat some saltine crackers, drink ginger ale, you'll be fine. And here I was like, I need you to put that in my chart. Like exactly what you said, I need you to put in my chart. And I'll never forget this. He turned around and he looked at me. He was like, excuse you. And I said, you heard what I said. I want it in my chart. If you don't believe me that something else can be going on, I want you to mark that in my chart. And immediately his demeanor, the way he spoke to me changed because he knew that I was someone who's, and my mom's a nurse. She was a labor and delivery nurse. She dealt with this. So like, he kind of just like looked at me like, okay, let's see what could be wrong. Immediately his attention changed. So it was like, if I were a white woman with blonde hair and blue eyes, because there are a lot of women who are diagnosed with HG at 6 and 7 weeks. So I don't know why it took me until 14 weeks for someone to actually say, you have HG. So I spent my entire first trimester, my face in the toilet in immense pain with no meds, no nothing, but with the basic that you give pregnant women, Unisum and B6. And it was like, would it have been different if I had blonde hair and blue eyes? And he didn't believe that I was in pain. It was kind of like, oh, that's just the way pregnancy goes. I have other friends who go through it who aren't Black, and they're diagnosed at 7 weeks when that's supposed to be the normal, you know, like morning sickness. So what made me so different? And then when you speak to other Black women, some of them went until 21 weeks and didn't get the right diagnosis. I mean, going to the hospital and my wife, she's a medic, having to push for them to give me an IV. Like if I've gone 24 hours and I can't hold water down, the protocol in hospitals is that you're supposed to give me an IV. But for some reason, my pain tolerance, because I'm a Black woman, makes total sense for me to wait for a doctor to give an okay. So it does affect my pregnancy, even like in the waiting room. I'm always just one of the only Black women in the waiting room who gets adequate care because I have good insurance. And it's like, even with that, it means nothing. The way the receptionist talks to me compared to like how she'll talk to my white counterparts are different. Small talk, they don't really make small talk with you. And it's always like when I'm in, like I'm deaf. I'm moderately to severely deaf. I wear hearing aids. And legally, you're supposed to provide the proper PPE to allow me to read your lips or a way for us to communicate. But a lot of times no one believes me because allegedly my speech is so clear that there's no way I could be deaf. Or it's the surprise that I'm an educated Black woman, that I am a PhD student, or that I actually have a career. And it's like these microaggressions are something that I deal with all the time. It's from the moment I wake up until the time I go to sleep. And it also affects me online. There are a lot of women who don't like my page and they make themselves very vocal in my messages and my comments on my TikTok. And I'm supposed to just deal with it because that's just what Black women have to deal with on a daily basis. And it's like, there are women who advocate other things like the formula shortage and gun control. And that's not political, but me talking about like people who look like me should just be treated fairly is the most controversial thing I could talk about. And I get so much hate all the time. And it's because a lot of people have been accustomed to either a Black woman is quiet or she's aggressive. And I decided that I was never raised to be quiet, so I won't be, because the point of my page is to educate others so that this doesn't happen to someone else, because this pregnancy journey has been very hard because I'm constantly being discriminated against.
Thank you for sharing that. And I can only begin to imagine, I guess, like the impact that that is having on you just from hearing your story and other people's stories. What I can imagine is being finally pregnant, and I didn't have the sickness, but the conversations I've had with other people as well, you know, like you're in such a vulnerable position with being finally pregnant and then feeling that, like, you know, severe sickness. And so then to A, have to advocate for yourself in those situations is one thing, but then to have the microaggressions and, you know, beyond that you have to deal with when you are feeling low, when you are feeling vulnerable, when you are feeling, it's bad enough, don't get me wrong, that one has to deal with them at any point in their lives. But in this particular point in your life, like that's just, like, it's just unspeakable really, isn't it? And it's just like unfair is just so under, you know, like just not the right word. It's such an understatement.
It's so frustrating because then I tried to explain it to other women, like, me and you are not the same. Like, yes, we're both pregnant and maybe we both have HG, but our experiences are the same, not the same, simply based, you're not a Black woman. Like, even me at my lowest and being sick, I still made sure that my hair was done. I looked decent and I was dressed decent because I would be mistreated simply because I'm Black and now I look messy. Oh. That could be a reason why someone doesn't want to see me or touch me, or want to do anything to help me. And I've had people write that in my chart. like, oh, patient came in disheveled. So that immediately will minimize my symptoms that I'm feeling, because now someone might think that I'm a crazy person or I'm seeking medication because I'm dressed a certain way. And I'm pretty sure my white counterparts don't have to worry about that. I've seen women in the ER wearing pajamas and get treated better than I have. But I have to put that into consideration, that I can't look unkept, because that can be another reason why my treatment is prolonged. So it's like simple things like that, that people don't even think about. And I'm like, this is my life every day. Like, being Black is exhausting. It's mentally taxing.
When I hear things like that, like, it wouldn't cross my mind, because I know that I would just turn up looking a wreck, you know, because I felt like a wreck. And the fact that you even have to consider not looking like a wreck when you feel like a wreck, when you're going to ask for help because you look, or because you feel like a wreck, you know, like, that's like, what? Why would you have to, like, you know, like, you just shouldn't have to worry about that. That shouldn't even be crossing your mind. Your health should be the thing on your mind at that point. You know, that's it, not how you look, or, you know, gosh, yeah. Just thank you for sharing, and thank you for talking about this. And how, talk to me, like, sorry, I'm kind of all over the place, like, with this, because I've got a couple of things and I'm just conscious of time. But one of the things that you've mentioned, and it's one of the things that comes up in the Five Times More survey, actually, is about that pain threshold thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, like, I had never heard that before. It's not something that I've ever considered, like, literally, it's nothing. It's something that I've never considered. And maybe that's wrong in itself, but I've never heard that before. And then to hear it there and elsewhere, and now you say, you know, this is something that is constant. This isn't just a one-off, is it?
It's very scary. And the closer, I started getting birth anxiety when I hit 30 weeks. I was like, this boy essentially can come out at any time. And we moved at 30 weeks. So I was in a different state, had to find all new doctors. And I just went into panic mode, because I'm like, all it takes for me to be at the wrong place at the wrong time with the right white person, and I can lose my life because they don't believe me that I'm in pain. And I try not to get emotional about it, but it scares me, because it's like, I worked so hard to have my son, and then there's a possibility that I won't make it because of the color of my skin. And that anxiety is so crippling, and people just don't understand unless you're me. And on my page, when I open up with that, or I share statistics and I urge other women to kind of share that, I get no response, or I get a really mean one saying that I make everything about race, but I didn't start it. White supremacy did. And it's like, the numbers don't lie. Like, Black women do die at higher rates than any other race because of the pain threshold. And that's during birth and postpartum. And that includes their babies too. And that gives me extreme anxiety, because at that point, there's nothing I can do but just to hope that I'm in the right hands at the right time. Because what if I have a doctor who believes these things? I'm in a position where there's nothing I can do but just to hope. And it gives me extreme anxiety. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cry.
Please do not apologize. Please, please do not. In the US, and I'm not familiar particularly with the US kind of medical system, but I know that often you'll have an OBGYN and it will be the same person that you will see. Will there be, like, will you have an opportunity for that to be the person that is there for your birth?
Yeah. So the way they do it's kind of weird, that some practices, they will, like, depending on your insurance, so the insurance that I have, where I go, they all see you. So all the midwives and the OBGYN see you, and they all get familiar with your chart. And whoever's on call would be the one to deliver your baby. And typically they'll have a midwife if you deliver vaginally. And if you need a C-section, then your OB would take over. But they all know me, like, I met them all. I've told them all about my fears. But I guess for me, with past history of being treated wrong because of the color of my skin, there's a distrust that I have with white medical professionals, because, you know, like, anything could happen. You know, they might have, like, you know, like, racial bias that they didn't even think about. that can contribute to something going wrong. And I think for me, the best way for me to try to control the situation is I don't want anything extra. Like, I don't want to be induced. I don't want, you know, like, I don't show signs that I need to be induced. So, like, kind of like let my body do what it's supposed to do. I don't want any extra medication because I'm just like afraid of setting myself up for something that could have been avoided. And I've expressed my concerns to my doctors and they don't give me any reason to worry. But, you know, like, I just, being Black in America is a very uncomfortable space that I'm always in. And I think that in the back of my mind, it's like I can't fully take myself there just because time and time again, people I'm supposed to trust hurt me. And it's not just me. A lot of Black people in the medical field have that distress because it's everywhere. You read on the news all the time that, you know, Black people are dying at higher rates than anybody else. And it's like, how can I trust you when every time I turn on the TV, I see someone like me dying? And then not just in, like, you know, like giving birth, walking to get Skittles and eating ice cream on their couch or sleeping in the bed with their boyfriend or driving their kid to the park or their kid playing with a toy gun at the park. So it's like I have this crippling anxiety because at any time, someone can just decide that I'm not deemed valuable and it gives me anxiety. And I think another part of my birth anxiety is that I'm bringing in a little Black boy that eventually won't be a little Black boy because society will desensitize you to that. And they make Black children grow up more than they should, faster than they should. And it's like, now it's like, it's a new fear that has been unlocked. And I know new moms have a lot of fears, like, oh, you know, like I love my kids so much. I don't want them to worry. But a fear a Black mother has for their Black child is completely different. Like, I remember me, like my dad, like I'm from New York, and my dad would sit us down every day and tell us how to be Black in America because the rates of people dying was insane, especially the era of like Trayvon Martin. And he would tell us, make sure you always get a receipt from the store. No hands in your pocket. Don't wear a hoodie. Take your hoodie off your head. It's yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. You can't stay out. Once the sun is down, you need to come home. You know what I mean? You can't play at this person's house. You can't play with water guns. You can't do this. You can't do that because of the fear that, again, that you'll be at the wrong place, the wrong time with the right white person. And it creates like anxiety that I don't want to give my child, but at the same time, I have to talk to him about like, not everyone in this world is going to like you. And I can't tell you why. And it just creates fear for me that, you know, I'm going to give birth to this amazing boy that some people just may not like, and I can't control that. And a lot of my birth anxiety comes for that because being Black, like I always tell people, is exhausting because there's nothing I can do. And even as much as I advocate and I bring awareness, a lot of people are just desensitized to the thought of the mistreatment of Black people, especially Black women, because it's been happening for so long. It's the same conversation with the same result. And it's exhausting. And even in the trying to conceive community, there aren't even a lot of us in there. Like you click a hashtag and it's like sprinkle a few Black women and the rest are all white. So no one cares to listen to your story because your timeline isn't diverse. So like when people find me, they're like, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know this. But it's like, it's also your job to go out and seek and diversify your timeline because there are really scary things happening to other people besides you.
Thank you so much for sharing. And it's overwhelming having all of those concerns for you as an individual and then to now be thinking, because it's overwhelming becoming a mother for the first time anyway, and then, but having the fact that you are a Black woman, having a Black son, having that anxiety that shouldn't be there. Let's face it, it really shouldn't be an anxiety. It shouldn't be a concern. But having that on top of becoming a new mother, it must be just beyond immense. I had a conversation, I guess it must have been last year with Nikki, who is a Black woman. She's our Pilates teacher for our finally pregnant Pilates. I remember talking to her and she was explaining similarly to you. And one of the points that she made was about the health, not healthcare, childcare. And, you know, is my child going to be the only Black child in the childcare setting? And that this was a concern. And, you know, I know from other feeds and bits and pieces, you know, but at the time it was the first time kind of thinking about that, you know, like and having that raised to me. And at the time we went through, I can't remember now exactly, it was the World Cup, was it the final perhaps? And there was just a huge uproar. Unfortunately, the gentleman who missed the penalty was a Black guy and there was a horrific racism. And Nikki and I spoke shortly after that and her concerns, you know, as a Black woman, you know, raising Black children and in the UK, and I can, you know, the gun crime, unfortunately, very recently, we have had the Texas mass shooting. And so like gun crime and like I am completely uneducated to talk about that as well. You know, I live in a completely different society. As far as I'm concerned, people shouldn't have them. You know, that's kind of my fairly black and white kind of statement on it. But it's, yeah, the fear is, it must be incredibly real and so wrong.
It's crippling. And like your friend mentioned, like, I worry about these things. So like, we're looking for daycare for him. I'm asking them race percentages, like how many Black kids come in? Like how many Black kids have you watched? How many Black kids have you, you know, dealt with? Are you aware of racism? Are you aware of microaggressions? The neighborhood we live in, like, is it Black friendly? Like, yes, it could be safe, but is it safe for my family? Because safety for someone who's white and safety for someone who's me is completely different. We can live in a place where there's no crime rate, but if there's high rates of racism, that's not a place for me and my family. Will my son be the only Black kid in his class? Because a lot of times when you are, because I've been in that position where I was the only Black girl in my class, people are fascinated by the color of your skin, your hair texture, how you look different. And, you know, like, kids will come back and say things to you, that ignorant things that their parents say. So it's like, you know, like it's something that I have to constantly consider. Like when we were living in Texas, I told my wife, like, we need to find a way that you renew your contract and fast, because Texas isn't a place that we raise Black children just because of how openly racist they are. And, you know, like that's something that we have to consider everywhere we go, even traveling. Is it a Black friendly place? Because I don't want to be at the wrong place at the wrong time with the right white person. And it's really just crippling because I can't live my life the way I want to, because I constantly have to be thinking seven steps ahead. Like, if I'm in this situation or Rue's in a situation, like, how could this be damaging for him? And it's scary. Like, even online, if you type in anyone's name who's been killed, like, and their murder was racially motivated, like, it's online for you to see. And it's like, I also have to protect Rue on the internet. Like, I have to limit, like, what he can see, because all he'll see is people who look like him dying. And it's just, I don't know, it's crippling. And like Nikki said, like, you even go as far as school, childcare, the neighborhood you live in, even where you're going out to dinner, like, is it worth it? And it's like, you just don't feel safe anywhere at all. And it's just something that, like, I feel like it, when it was just me and Yvette, we worried about it, but it was like a different kind of worry. And even now I'm like, I hope he comes out at 40 weeks. And even though I'm like physically dying and I know that, you know, like he should come out soon, I just don't want the world to get a hold of him yet. So I just want to keep him in, because once he's out, I can't protect him the way I want to when he's inside. And it's part of my anxiety is being a Black woman living in America. That we don't have much say or much rights, or people don't really care. And it's really hard. Like, how do I explain that to a child that I don't see anything wrong with you, but other people might? And I think that's like the hardest conversation that I think I'm going to have with him. And I just don't know how. I don't know how my dad did it with me. I don't know how my mom did it with me. You know, like, I don't know how, like, what was going through their mind. Like, my sister, she has a 5-year-old son, and she had to talk to him about it because he starts school in August. And it's like, you know, like, how do you do that and build their confidence at the same time? Because it's hurtful that you have to be extra careful for something that you can't control. And it's like, no matter how much I prepare him, that's all I can do, and just hope that he comes home every day. And it's scary.
It is scary. It is scary. And I can only hope that conversations like this will have some impact. Like, however, you know, like I'm just going small because of the size of this podcast, you know, it's fairly niche, but just more and more of these conversations. And I just like, thank you so much for sharing. And thank you so much for being on Instagram and sharing your message, you know, like for people like me to hear and for people like other people to hear, you know, it's just, it is so important. And it is something that I'm learning as I'm going, you know, and I continue to do that. And I continue to want to kind of hear, however uncomfortable it is, because you're, you know, this is the uncomfortable that you're living, the scare that you're living. And that's something that we definitely want to change without question. So,
and I feel like, I want to just say that, like, say that a lot of people are uncomfortable, and it's like, it's okay to be uncomfortable, but it's not okay to be silent. Like, it's okay to ask me questions. It's okay to be like, hey, I didn't know this. It's okay to ask, how do I help? The point is that, like, silence is compliance. Like, you just want to make sure you're trying to do something, even if it starts at home and talking to your child about things, or talking to your partner, your best friend, or your mom. Like, you just want to start somewhere, because the more aware people become, the less likely, you know, someone falls victim to a microaggression. Or, you know, like, a lot of people sometimes say things to me and they don't understand that it's a microaggression because no one ever corrected them, you know? And it's like, I don't think everyone in the world is racist. I just think everybody in the world is ignorant. And it's very important for you to diverse your timeline and just talk to other people and learn, because not everyone is privileged like you are. And it's okay. And you're, there's nothing wrong with having privilege, because you can't control it. But it definitely, like, if you do have privilege, you should use it for good instead of just being silent.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much for being so, yeah, just everything, really. And gracious, I guess, was the word that was coming to mind. But I kind of, you've been so much more than that as well. So thank you so much. One thing that I do want to, if you don't mind us just ending on, I did notice on your Instagram, and I haven't been spending loads of time on Instagram over the last few weeks for various reasons, but I did happen to notice that it's Haitian Mother's Day. Was that today?
Yes.
Which is very special for you, isn't it?
It's extremely special. It's something I grew up, my dad's Haitian, and I grew up like really indulged in my culture. And one of the best things I think that I'm excited about motherhood is I get to share the same experiences that I had as a child with Rue. And it's even better than like American Mother's Day, because it's something that I just wanted to celebrate so bad. And my dad was like the first person who called me this morning to wish me a happy Haitian Mother's Day. And it's just been fun. It's like, you know, like with everything going on, like I was just looking forward to this day, and it's been the best day ever, just because, like, you know, this is something that I wanted for so long. And it's like the most positive thing that ever came out of my pregnancy is celebrating Haitian Mother's Day. And I woke up in a good mood, still in a good mood, just on the sole fact that, like, this is something cultural that I really wanted to share with my son. And I finally get to.
That's amazing. Amazing. Well, happy Mother's Day to you. And I will be excitedly watching. I know that, I think I saw that you're not going to be sharing too much about the birth, but, you know, like to share hopefully when little Rue arrives very safely. And yeah, do stay in touch. But thank you so much for joining me and sharing your story and, yeah, just talking so openly.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. All right, then. Well, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.